Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app.
Welcome back to the weekly roundup on the Dialogue with Dewa De Boer and William McGimpsey on Reality Check Radio. And it's no longer really the weekly roundup, although I haven't settled on a new name yet, more like the weekly startup, perhaps, well, where we talk about the events of last week. And sometimes even the week before, we will try and do an in-depth dive on some of the really big issues from the last week and week and a half, 2 weeks. And it's been, again, another very, very busy week. Welcome back, William.
Well, thanks, Dewa. Nice to be here. Excited about the brand new show.
Well, it's a brand new time slot. The show is the same, and the issues are sort of the same. We're going to pick up a few threads internationally, and we'll start with the US election at the moment. And last Wednesday, we had a debate between former President Donald Trump and current Vice President Kamala Harris. And what were your impressions from that debate and how you sort of think the last 2 months of that election are going to shape up?
Well, there's a few things to say. I think Kamala Harris probably did slightly better than I expected her to. She opened up the debate in her first response. She did say something like a scripted and quite inane, like I was expecting her to. But in her subsequent answers, she got better, and she was actually treated it like a debate. She was engaging with Trump, trying to get under his skin a little bit. And so she didn't come off too bad, I didn't think, in the debate. In terms of the issues, I thought the most notable thing was immigration. And the first question that Trump got was about the economy. And he pivoted very quickly to the immigration issue and talked about, you know, the huge numbers of people surging over the border and how Kamala Harris is responsible for that. And that was a sort of that sort of thing went on in other questions as well. Like, a lot of immigration was brought in in a lot of the questions, and rightly so. It's a big issue in the States. And what was really, I thought, the most fun and the most interesting bit was when he talked about the Haitian migrants in Springfield, Ohio. And he said, they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats, they're eating people's pets. And
that was the highlight of the debate for me. In fact, it sparked a larger debate about whether or not dogs and cats were being eaten. But I think that's a little bit beside the point. Yes, it is happening. But the image that you have there, the image that millions and millions of people got watching that was amazing.
Yeah. And you know, it's a little bit fun. I think there is actually some of that going on, which is a bit worrying. But that's not really the real issue. The real issue is the big problem that these large numbers of third world immigrants are causing in America and in many other countries as well. So Springfield is a town of 60,000 people. So reasonably small. And 20,000 of them are recently arrived Haitian migrants. And that's just the sheer numbers alone is going to cause a huge difference in terms of the pressure it puts on housing, housing availability, housing prices, and the services that the town provides to its citizens. And that's before we even get into the, you know, the big cultural differences. The reason I think that this issue is so important and it goes viral is because it really rubs liberal sensibilities the wrong way, because it points out that people aren't all equal and that there are important differences in how people act and how they behave. And, you know, to put it crudely, the level of civilizedness between different groups of people. And liberals don't want to admit that. They like the idea, it makes them feel good to think of people as all being the same, as all being equal in some sort of way. But that's just not true. And if you don't take basic differences between different groups of people, different races, different cultures, etc., into account in things like immigration policy and many other areas of public policy, you're going to end up hurting your own community and end up with absurd sort of situations like we're seeing in Springfield, Ohio, and many other places in the United States and elsewhere.
I was sort of surprised with how this story exploded, because I had just talked on Monday's show, last Monday's show, about Haitian. I've done a little bit of a recap on Haitians and the story in Haiti with Kaiden McCormack. And he and I had spoken months ago about the breakdown of civil order in Haiti and the history behind that. Very interesting show. If you're listening to this afterwards, go and look it up, quickly note it down. But I think we called it Fear and Loathing in Port-au-Prince. And yeah, I guess you can run Haiti into the search bar of RCI and find that interview that I did with Kaiden. And that was months and months ago. And then even last week, I said, hey, I heard this story about a small town in America that had like maybe 4,000 people and then had like 2,000 Haitians. I had only scanned the story and didn't realize it was a town that was 40,000 and then had 20,000 Haitians flown in because of the breakdown of order there. But yeah, they had this warlord by the name of Barbecue running the show, and they had all this these stories of cannibalism, like people being fried up in the streets, and the voodoo that they engage in, which includes like eating people's pets and cats, and all of that's very, very real. A really big problem in Haiti. And instead of actually fixing Haiti, they just decided to fly, and Kamala Harris mentioned this in an interview that she did or a video, that she flew like 100,000 people from Haiti into the United States. And these are people that, you know, they border the Dominican Republic. Like the Dominicans have built a giant wall to keep out the Haitians. The saying there is like, oh yes, the religion of Haiti is like 30% Protestant, 40% Catholic, and 100% voodoo. That's the reputation that country has. And then just to pick people out of there and drop them in the middle of Ohio is completely insane. I mean, it's probably worse than insane. You say it's criminal. And then I did not expect this to become the issue in the presidential debate, you know, because I've been covering the story in the background for months. Quite a spectacular thing to have happen.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, we've been hearing stories. We hear these stories and these reports and these news stories out of Europe about, you know, migrants raping European girls and migrant violence, migrant terrorist attacks, migrant knife attacks. This should really be getting through to people that this is a serious problem. It's not just about far-right violent extremists promoting propaganda. There's a real problem here with the behavior of these migrants in first world Western countries. And it's been very hard to get through to, you know, people on the left, the liberal elite, whatever we want to call them, to get them to try and do something.
Well, about if
it.
You do polling on this issue, consistently in every country, 70 to 80% of people will say, you know, no thanks. Can we not have any more of these people? It's not going well. The vast majority, overwhelming majority, a super majority of people say, please, let's not do this. And it's not possible for them to vote for it. They can't get a government that will actually put a stop to it.
Yeah. So we're supposed
to
have democracy.
You're not allowed to stop it.
Yeah. No, you're racist if you want to stop it, and racism's not allowed. So if you don't like it, we're going to do it to you anyway. That's your punishment for being racist, is to inflict the thing you don't want on you. But, you know, the rapes, the murders, the knife attacks, the terrorism hasn't got through to people. Maybe eating the pets will get through to people. Maybe this is the, I'm hopeful, you see, maybe this is the thing that will finally change the people in charge's mind.
Because, yeah, it's interesting, you know, the whole story of the pets and is it real? How much of this is happening? Suddenly people are interested. There was a story last week as well of a teenage boy who was murdered by a Haitian migrant, and they even got like his parents to do one of the like Maoist struggle sessions where the father had to read out the statement, or had to, you know, probably he did it voluntarily. Maybe, who knows if he was coerced. He basically said, I wish my son had been killed by a white man, because then we, you know, these racists wouldn't be turning this into a political issue.
And you hear this sort of thing, don't you? When we remember, we used to have a few years ago, we used to have terrorist attacks, and you'd hear about like the left wingers and the liberals. They'd be, you know, as the news of it's coming in, they're sitting there secretly hoping that it's a white person, so they don't have to deal with the fact that it's a migrant or a minority community committing the terror attack. But anyway, I mean, it's bad news. It's bad stuff that's happening. But let's try and look at it in a positive way. This, in some ways, is Trump going back to running his campaign in the same way he did in 2016, with these fun and subversive issues, generating buzz on social media. I mean, the AI images of Trump protecting the kittens and the ducks that we've seen on social media, that, I mean, I've had a lot of fun with that.
They even ran some on the RCR Bytes newsletter. For all of you listeners who haven't subscribed to a foundation membership of RCR, you actually got some of those memes in your inbox last week.
Yeah, quality content.
And so this is the issue that Trump hammered home. The debate was insanely biased as well. He was debating the moderators as well. It was clearly...
They fact-checked him on the Haitian migrants, didn't they? And I'm not sure their fact-checking was correct there. They referred to the police... Well, not the police chief, but the whoever it was in the city governance person refuting these claims. But I mean, people aren't always honest, and there are good reasons for someone like that to refute the claims, even if they know that things like that really are going on. And besides, that's an appeal to authority. We have sort of pictures. We have video recordings. We can see that some of this stuff definitely has happened. I think there was an article recently in The Federalist, actually, where they verified some of these claims. So there is, you know, Trump disagreed with the moderators as they were trying to fact check him live. And he said, you know, well, we'll see, we'll find out. And I think that we will. I mean, this is the pattern that happened in 2016 and other times where there would be an outrageous statement made by Trump or someone in the Trump campaign. It would be refuted and fact-checked by the mainstream media. But then over time, in the week or two that followed, eventually it would come out that the outrageous statement was actually correct. And you get the feeling that that's what's going to happen here as well.
And then you saw the lineup. The thing that sort of shocked me about Kamala Harris is her responses were just rehearsed, very well rehearsed. She just not very interesting to me. But the thing she was touting, like saying, I've been endorsed by Dick Cheney. I've been endorsed by the McCain family. I've been endorsed by like every single neoconservative involved in the Bush administration. All of these people who love foreign wars, who want to intervene in every country, the war hawks. They want to glass the Middle East, whatever they've been saying this whole time. This is basically for Kamala Harris to get on stage and say, oh, yes, I've been endorsed by the entire Bush administration, who are all apparently the devil incarnate, or they used to be until yesterday. They were considered to be devils by the left, by the Democrats. And now suddenly they're saints because they've endorsed Kamala Harris.
Yeah, well, she is doing some different, strange sorts of things with her campaign and her campaign messaging, like endorsing a lot of conservative policies endorsing and taking up some of Trump's policy positions in some areas. So that's an interesting tactic, and we'll see how that goes.
And then any final thoughts you had on that debate that you think are worth mentioning, or we sort of covered the really important parts for listeners?
Yeah, I mean, in summary, I'll just repeat myself a little bit. Kamala Harris did better than expected, but Trump also did well. And in some ways, it was a return to 2016 Trump form, focusing on immigration and having these, you know, controversial and interesting and subversive issues to talk about.
Well, thank you very much for your thoughts on that. And roughly, yeah, I think I'm much in agreement in that a lot of pundits will try and nitpick who won the debate. But the debate was really a case of not losing a debate. And that's what these debates are off. Like, can you not lose a debate? Can you do well enough? Can you not make any major stuff ups that you stay in the race and maintain your position? Your base is happy with your performance. And this is what it basically seems like. Trump's base and his team is happy with his performance. Kamala Harris's team is happy with her performance. The media did a good job propping her up. The previous debate was so disastrous for Joe Biden and it knocked him out of the race. And they're clearly very keen to keep Kamala Harris propped up. I think her team's even keen to do another debate. They hadn't locked in another debate. They weren't sure. They thought this might go so badly they wouldn't want to do another debate. The fact that they want to do another debate means that they're comfortable with how she did in it. Probably not going to shift the needle, but I think this is basically the first time that people have seen her live. You know, she hasn't done any interviews. They did one pre-taped interview before this. So it will be interesting to see how those go. The polls still very, very tight. We'll have to see if anything changes with the polls after the debate. Again, unlikely that there's any big difference there, because Kamala Harris is only about 1 or 2 percentage points ahead in many of the national polls. And this is very different to 2020, 2016, where the Democrat candidate was always up 5, 7, 8, 9 points. So this isn't looking good for her unless they've fixed their polling. And in many of the leading swing states as well, Trump's either leading or very, very close. And he doesn't need to win a majority. He needs like 47 to 48%, and then he's guaranteed to win the election. If he gets 46%, it's anybody's game. If he gets 47, 48%, it's basically over for Kamala Harris.
Yeah, it's all about those swing states, isn't it? And doing well enough
in those swing states. Just one final thing on the debate now that we've mentioned the swing states is Trump did go very heavy on Pennsylvania, on fracking. Like, he made her pick up his positions. He even said he was going to buy her a MAGA hat because she was copying all his policies. So you can really tell she's on the defensive in those swing states like Pennsylvania, which at the moment she looks like she's going to lose that quite badly, at least Pennsylvania, which is great news for Trump. Moving to other parts of the world, we've been speaking about France a few weeks, and after the elections there, they finally picked a new prime minister, Michel Barnier. And what are your thoughts? He comes from the conservative faction, the Republicans in France, but he is a technocrat, a Eurocrat. He was involved with the Brexit negotiations for the European Union. He's coming from one of the smaller parties in the French Parliament. And I'm not even sure if he's actually a member of the parliament. I couldn't figure that out. I tried to look this up. Maybe he does have a small electorate or whatever they call them that he holds there. But that wasn't immediately clear to me either. It seemed like he was a high-level bureaucrat who had sort of been parachuted in because they couldn't agree on any of the larger parties. They couldn't agree on the prime minister.
Yeah, well, I think he's France's oldest prime minister. It's 73. And there's some polling that says he is thought of as competent and a safe pair of hands and likable and these sorts of things. But I think you have to hand it to Macron here. His sort of centre-right or centrist parties took a hammering. And the populist right did very well in the election, and the left in the final results did well and sort of squished the centre-right and the centre down to nothing. Yet he still managed to pick a centre-right prime minister. So, I mean, is this political genius? I don't know.
Macron is one of the greatest political geniuses of our day. Everybody hates him. I'm sure almost everyone listening to the show hates Macron. But if anything, he is a survivor. He's one of these political geniuses who is always able to squeeze out a win, even in the most dire situation. And this is, like you say, this is complete evidence of his political genius. There's no other way to put it.
Well, he called that election early, and everyone thought that he had committed a grievous error and he was going to lose the election to the so-called far right. And that hasn't eventuated at all. In the end, that strategy has, even though it looked like it definitely wasn't going to come off, it has in the end. He's sort of been vindicated here.
So he has support. So this prime minister has support from Macron's centrist party. It has support from the Republicans, obviously, because he himself is from the Republican Party, the more conservative party. And even the National Rally, the so-called far-right party, has basically said, yeah, we're happy with him as well. And it's only the leftist parties, the Popular Front, that are up in arms, very upset about this. I wouldn't say that anybody in particular seems happy, but they're simply satisfied, with the exception of the left, who claim that they've been betrayed, that their electoral surge, their getting the plurality of the votes has been rejected. The popular will, they claim, has been rejected. Do you see any consequences for France, for Macron or any of the centre-right on sort of shutting the left out? This seems to me to be a very similar debate to 2017, where we had the National Party be the largest party, but they were shut out of power. Like, it's it could create lasting grievances for some people, but in New Zealand's case, it didn't have any real consequences. It's simply politics, right?
Yeah, although there is this phenomenon that was activated in France. I forget the name of it now, but they've got a name for something where all the parties mobilize together and do deals to try and shut out the far right. Mm-hmm. And they did that. They activated that, and that reduced the vote of National Rally in the final electoral tally. But now the left-wing parties who did well in that final surge have sort of been undercut by Macron. So I just wonder, I don't know, but I just wonder what that means in future for this tactic of all banding together to
Yeah,
against the far right. Is that going to undermine that tactic?
Hopefully. We can hope. But it's either, it's always been said, either France or Germany will be the first to crack. I think the term is firewall that they use. They put up a firewall to stop the actual right-wing parties from having power. And they're holding this up in Germany now, even with the Alternative for Deutschland getting the largest party in a state. They're still being shut out. So that firewall is still holding up in Germany. And I interviewed Peter Behringer from the AfD 2 weeks ago now, and he seemed to think that was going to be the case ongoing until they win an outright majority. But yeah, the national rally looks like it's closer to cracking this firewall that's been put in place in Europe.
Yeah, we'll have to see how that turns out.
Now, one last international issue quickly, Australia. The Prime Minister has once again proposed a social media ban for young people. And the arguments here are that social media is bad for young people and distracts them and causes bullying issues and so on, that parents aren't doing a good job keeping young people away from social media. But I know that you have a view that the ban here that they're proposing is a little bit more nefarious than that. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. Well, there is some research that suggests that young people can be harmed by social media. So it's not completely fake what they're doing, but there's a lot of stuff on the internet that isn't social media that's probably more harmful, which they're not aiming to ban. And there's a lot of stuff happening in the schools these days, yeah, and elsewhere that's possibly harmful as well, which they're certainly not looking to ban that. But what I think is that social media has been instrumental in changing the political trajectory and changing the political views of a lot of people, particularly young people. And it's really moving the needle. It was a big factor in the recent European Parliament elections, where parties to the right did better. They surged a little bit, didn't take power fully, but it's moving the needle there, and it's moving the needle elsewhere. You can see the effect that social media is having in the US election that it had in 2016. And Brexit and all around the world. So I feel like there's a motivation there to try and shut young people out of social media, to reestablish the monopoly on young people's minds that the left has through the education system.
Yeah, and I'll give you an example of some analysis that I wrote for RCR's blog into the poll that was done on Trump support in New Zealand. And among Zoomers, Trump support was twice as high as among boomers. So Zoomers are twice more likely to support Donald Trump in New Zealand than boomers and people over 60. So that alone tells you that, basically people who are not listening to mainstream media are people who are not watching TV, not watching the 6 o'clock news, but they're spending their time on TikTok and Instagram and X, are far more likely to have what they would call populist, conservative, right-wing, patriotic, nationalist sort of views. And that seems to be increasingly the case. The AfD, again, largest party among young people, national rally, largest among young people. Trump now is picking up larger numbers of the youth vote as well, according to the polls. So we see this holding up. Not just a theory that you have, William, we have the data to back it up.
And it's a break from what had been the historical trend of the younger generations tending to be more left-wing and the older generations tending to be more right-wing. That pattern is breaking down now, and social media and the internet is probably a large part of that. But there's other risks.
I think as well, by the way, COVID lockdowns probably, which was basically sacrifice the young people for the old, I think may have had a very radicalizing effect as well on these young people who realize that they have had years of their life stolen away, and for what?
Yeah. The risk here is, in order to really enforce that, you've got to have some sort of a digital identification, a verification technology that you use to screen people out from accessing the internet. And once you have that in place, there's no reason it can't be expanded to other age groups, other demographic groups, individuals in general. So there's a huge potential for the abuse of censorship power here. And if they implement this, if they get the technology and the legislation in place to be able to do it, it could over time expand and bring an end to the free and open internet, which would be, I think, a terrible tragedy for free speech and a terrible tragedy for general enlightenment and an improvement of political decision making by the mass of people.
I had one more item from Australia here, but it has to do with immigration. So we'll do New Zealand immigration first. You've got the July figures now from Stats New Zealand on what immigration was. So it's time for your regular great replacement update.
Yeah. So the number of immigrants coming into New Zealand is still very high, over 200,000 in the year to July 2024. There are, however, large numbers now also leaving, approximately 133,000 people, migrants, departures during that year. We also have, so that means that the net migrants who are coming here is around 67,000 over that year, which is a lower figure than it had been because there weren't so many people leaving. Now, there are record numbers of New Zealanders leaving the country. We've set records in quite a few of the previous months for the number.
That's right, three or four months in a row now.
Yep. Yeah, for the number of New Zealanders leaving the country, and we've done so again, both in terms of the total departures of New Zealand citizens, which is at 80-something thousand, and the net departure of New Zealand citizens, because you have to remember that in every time period, there are also New Zealand citizens from overseas coming back. So the total departures are some 80-something thousand, and the net is around 55, approximately. And the people who are coming into the country are large numbers of Indians, large numbers of Filipinos, large numbers of Chinese. The people who are leaving are the vast majority of New Zealanders, and then there's many Australians, British people, and Americans. So you can see the types of people who are coming in and the types of people that are leaving. And I think that most, you know, like it's a cultural replacement, basically, that's going on. The traditional New Zealander is leaving the country and being replaced by Indians, Chinese, Filipino type people.
And I always provide the monthly numbers as well. I know the stats usually run year to year, but we talked about the monthly trend from changes that the Minister for Immigration, Erica Stanford, made several months ago. And arrivals had been trending down slightly in May. That's 17,000, down to 15,000 in June. But then in July, they've gone back up, 17,500 arrivals just in that month. Again, departures, as you said, are climbing, 12,000 departures in July. And the gain has really changed as well, because we were gaining only 1,000 people last month. We had lost 2,000 people the month before that, and now suddenly we're up again, just over 5,000 people in July. And the reason that's been given for that is the arrival of student visas, basically. And it's a strange time of the year, I think, for students to be arriving. But in July, we had 6,000 students that arrived in the country. That seems to be a really big avenue, and that's part of the Australian issue I was going to mention. They had protests in Australia with students who wanted their visas made permanent, and also problems that they have in Australia in terms of rentals. So they have nearly 800,000 students in Australia, 800,000 foreign students in Australia, and these are all people who require apartments, rentals, and the price of housing and rentals and all other types of accommodation has just gone through the roof in Australia. Potentially, we have a similar effect in New Zealand with large numbers of foreign students. And then you get protests of those students who want their visas made permanent. They don't want to go back. They've got their education, but they actually want to stay here. They don't want to go back to, say, a third world country that they came from to study here.
Well, those are huge numbers of students in Australia. That's like that's massive.
Yeah, that's I see here Jordan Knight, who was kicked out of ABC Q&A last minute. He had a question where he basically said that, yeah, 800,000 means that one in every 34 people in Australia is a foreign student, and that they have 12% of the world's total foreign student population. Not that bad in New Zealand, but I think if you start to adjust per capita, we don't look too flash either.
I think one of the things that may be causing this, and I know this is true in New Zealand, and I'm not as sure in Australia what the situation is. But in New Zealand, the universities have changed in recent decades, really, the way they operate. And it's a sort of bums on seats model where they make money out of the students. And in some ways, it's a better deal to get foreign students because New Zealand students get all sorts of government subsidies, whereas the foreign students do not. But I just wonder whether the people who are doing this sort of financial modelling of the business case for the universities are really taking into account a lot of the economic costs, the externalities that come from the taking up the housing demand and the pressure on public services and all the other problems and costs that are created by having a large number of foreign students in the country. And I would suggest that if you were to do that, if you were to run that analysis again with a more careful consideration of some of those externalities and some of those costs, the net benefit to New Zealand or Australia or any other nation of running a policy like this might be somewhat less favourable. And so, I mean, I think universities should really focus on educating your own people. You can have some foreign students, sure. I mean, but not large numbers in order to make money like that. We should be educating our best and brightest, and we should be focused on giving them the best educational programs that we can, not lowering standards to bring in more and more people in order to make money. That's not really the ideal thing for a university to be doing.
And have you got any other final thoughts then on the immigration issue and the trends here? I already raised the question of whether or not the changes that Erica Stanford had made were working. They sort of seem to be working in terms of the visas that are being given out on work visas for lower skilled immigrants. That was always a big problem. But then you suddenly see another category explode, like student visas that we've talked about. So does the government really have a grasp on the problem, or are they trying to ignore it?
Well, it's not, they haven't solved it yet, have they? Like we still have over 200,000 people coming into the country. And you know, people might run the argument that, oh, there's so many people leaving, so we need to bring more people in. But actually, when you look at the reasons why people are leaving, it's the bringing in of people that's driving people out. Yeah. So I think that causality is around the wrong way.
And you can see the GDP per capita going down, which means that you're bringing in more people and everyone in the country is getting poorer, basically.
Yeah, and I mean, it's complicated what's driving the GDP to go down. I think immigration is one factor, but there are many other factors. We are, you know, the economy is sluggish at the moment in general. But yes, there is this effect of, because if you have more people, you're going to have more GDP just because people do some sort of economic activity. But the absolute level of the GDP isn't really what matters in terms of living standards for ordinary people. It's the GDP per capita It's the total amount of economic activity divided by the number of people that really gives you an indication of the living standards on the country and whether they're going up or down. And they have been going down in recent times.
And now for our big local political issue, the Treaty Principles Bill was finally announced last week. The details of it, the actual text that will be voted on by Parliament and go to the New Zealand public for consultation, and we'll get a full 6-month consultation. But in the days before that, we also had church leaders, over 400 of them, basically protest against this bill being introduced. So they hadn't even read yet at the time, so they were protesting protesting against a principle that they had not been read. What's your overall view on the Treaty Principles Bill, now that you've actually seen it, and a lot of the objections that people had before they saw it?
Well, I think the letter written by the church leaders illustrates one of the key problems I have with the Treaty Principles Bill. There's much to support in what David Seymour and ACT are attempting to achieve with this Treaty Principles Bill. I think his arguments around, you know, letting ordinary people have a say in their own constitutional arrangements rather than letting it be drafted up by lawyers in the Waitangi Tribunal and public servants just sneaking in treaty principles into the legislation, I think that is appropriate, that ordinary people should have a say there. But one of the things that the church leaders letter pointed out is that the Treaty Principles Bill, as drafted by David Seymour, doesn't take account of the collective rights of Maori. And this is an important point, because if you listen to the language that David Seymour uses when he's speaking about his Treaty Principles Bill, especially when he's talking about the idea of self-determination. Self-determination is a collective right. It's a collective human right. Now, David Seymour is someone who takes human rights very seriously. I think this is correct, that when he took his oath to swear into Parliament, rather than using the Bible, he used a copy of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So it's obviously something important.
That's his Bible, yeah.
But one of the rights it's actually in a different document, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, is the right of self-determination. And it's a collective right rather than an individual right. And I don't think David Seymour believes in collective rights. And so when you hear him talking about the right of self-determination, he describes it in these airy-fairy ways about individuals deciding what type of person they want to be and how they want to live their lives and this sort of stuff. And that's not what it means.
He's a sovereign citizen.
Self-determination isn't an individual thing. It's a collective thing.
Absolutely.
It's a group of people being able to determine their own political destiny. And that means if they want to have their own state, they want to have their own country, then you've got to make, as much as practicality allows, you've got to allow them to have that sort of thing, to decide their own fate, to manage their own affairs in their own way, and to preserve and protect their own culture. That's what self-determination means. And because he has this libertarian ideology, I don't think he really believes in that. And I think that is a problem. I think if he had his way, and he talks often about New Zealand being a modern, liberal, multi-ethnic democracy. The problem with that is if you can never define who you are and exclude people who are different from you. And it means you can have no collective culture, you can have no collective identity, and you have no means of preserving it because
he wants to get rid of any
recognition
in New Zealand with that. But he wants to get rid of, he's like, oh, we need to get rid of all the public holidays because people should get to decide what they want to celebrate when they do it. And he doesn't believe there should be like collective national holidays, basically. It's the same, it's highly radical individualism where you can somehow you can have a nation without a common culture or any kind of common beliefs and practices to bind you together. A very strange belief, because I don't think that's ever happened in all of history, and it seems to be completely impossible to build a nation where nobody has anything in common.
Well, we're back to the problem of the French Revolution that Edmund Burke wrote his book about, you know, all these ideals about liberty, equality, and fraternity. It's all very well, but if you're going to radically rejig the institutions and the culture and the way of life of ordinary people, and you're going to kill a bunch of people in the process, then is the juice really worth the squeeze there?
So to get to the actual proposed bill now, so what he was suggesting before, and this is specifically, I think the first article and the first principle that they've put forward is not very controversial in the sense he says that the ACT Party was put as suggesting the New Zealand government has the right to govern all New Zealanders, which has become part of the draft bill with a more fluff around it, but it basically still says the same thing. And that seems to be fairly uncontroversial. It's the second article, the second principle, that was controversial, as you said, where he suggested that New Zealand government honors all New Zealanders in the chieftainship of their land and their property. So that kind of self-determination for all New Zealanders at an individual level has now been changed to say, or at least in the draft bill, has been put forward that the Crown recognizes the rights that Hapu and Iwi had when they signed the treaty, and the Crown will respect and protect those rights. And those rights differ from the rights everyone has a reasonable expectation to enjoy only when they are specified in legislation, treaty settlements, or other agreements with the Crown, which it seems to open the door more to what you're talking about, that there's a collective self-determination that Hapu and Iwi have, and that they're free to negotiate this with the Crown. To me, that seems quite positive. Maybe the Hobson's Pledge people are going to be mad about this. You know, we'll have to see in the coming weeks as to how this develops. Do you see this as like a workable solution? Does this actually address the concern that, say, these church leaders had and various other people and Iwi and Hapu themselves have put forward? Does this legitimately address a concern that they had to ensure that that is one of the principles, to say that Hapu and Iwi have some collective rights that are unique in context?
Yeah, it seems to be a movement in that direction. And I think Willie Jackson made some positive sounds in Parliament or maybe outside Parliament about that. So it does seem to have been welcomed at least somewhat, although I think we're going to have to see how that develops.
Now, one more thing then quickly there is that this is going through a 6-month select committee process. So this could get very, very interesting. Like people who have ruled this out have now suddenly seen, oh, wow, David Seymour has made some big concessions. Maybe people want to get involved and maybe they can come up with some, they can refine the principles and you might actually get buy-in from a lot of these different groups who are, have been radically opposed to this. So this could be a very fascinating process to follow. And certainly I see this as a good step as the right step in a far more positive direction. But then again, I'm hearing a lot of grumbling still from people around me. So, you know, we'll keep an eye on it. But it's sort of a shift from like one people, one nation to like two peoples, one nation approach, which seems to be something that more people will rally around.
There is a tension between the one law for all ideal and recognizing the collective rights of iwi and hapu. The other thing that isn't mentioned here that I'd like to inject is that it's not just Maori who have a right to self-determination. There's another group here who helped, who did something, were quite significantly involved in the founding of New Zealand as a nation, and who are the demographic and cultural majority here, and that would be white British New Zealanders, whatever we want to call ourselves, the people formerly known as New Zealanders. We have a right to self-determination too, and what I want is that to be recognised. It doesn't have to be recognised in the treaty bill, but it has to be recognised in some way, because with the mass immigration that we've talked about going on, we are gradually losing that right to govern ourselves according to our own culture, our own values, our own way of life, because we have to compromise with the views, the values, and the different opinions of these other minority groups we're bringing into the country. So I want self-determination for me and my group of people as well. And I don't think that's too much to ask. I think that's a human right.
That's fair enough. And thank you for interjecting that at the end. I was just going to say I had a few other topics to get into, but we're just out of time for this week. So thank you very much, William. I think that's just a good note to end things on. And I'll remind the audience as well, forgot to say this at the beginning, please do text in on 2057, email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you. And we will be back again next Monday with another weekly roundup or a weekly look back. I'm still not sure what we're going to call it. Do help us out with a name for the segment. We'll get some more. We'll throw some ideas around internally as well. But I think the segment still works very, very well because we've got a greater period of time to look back over. Thank you, William, for joining us. And as always, I'll remind people, go and check him out on X, the Zeitgeist, William McGimsey. Definitely give him a follow. He posts lots of very interesting things almost every day.
Thanks, Stuart.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.